Number two, the Texas Senate has acquitted Attorney General Ken Paxton in his impeachment trial. What a shock. What a surprise. And lastly, Bill Maher will return to his show despite the continuing writer's strike. Who's furious? Who's happy? Is this the right decision? Wrong decision? We will discuss all of it on today's bonus show. Join Pacman.com.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
That's right. If Alex Jones hates it that much, it must be something worthy of checking out. And as a reminder, membership prices have been level for a decade. When the new website launches, membership prices go up. What better thing to do than get the lower price today and let everybody else get screwed by inflation in the future? No, in all seriousness, prices will be going up. Join Pacman.com. Coupon code 4 years for indictments saves you 50%. We'll see you. We start today with the impeachment of President Joe Biden, which, of course, is not happening for right now. Republicans are launching an impeachment inquiry into Joe Biden. Congresswoman Nancy Mace went on CNN last week, was asked for evidence and said, "We don't have it. That's why we're doing the inquiry, to look for the evidence." This made no sense. She was roundly humiliated. Hundreds of thousands of you watched our clip on the matter and widely thought this is a very strange way to pursue the truth, by saying we don't have evidence, but let's investigate someone and see what we find. Well, Nancy Mace apparently has not gotten any better talking points over the weekend, because she went back on TV yesterday, was interviewed on ABC, and she still has no evidence nor any semblance of evidence. Let's take a look at what she had to say. This is difficult to watch.
Let me also ask you, before you go, the impeachment inquiry that McCarthy announced, even though he had said he wouldn't do it without a vote, and then a few days later he does it without a vote. I want to read you something that Ken Buck, one of your Republican colleagues, had to say in a Washington Post op-ed of the impeachment inquiry. He said, "Impeachment is a serious matter and should have a foundation of rock-solid facts. Trump's impeachment in 2019 was a disgrace to the Constitution and is a disservice to Americans. The GOP's reprise in 2023 is no better." He says these allegations against the Biden family are part of an imagined history and a fictitious version of events. Was this premature, going all the way with an impeachment inquiry?
I don't believe so. The facts are everywhere. There are text messages. There are emails. There are witnesses. There are whistleblowers. There are meetings. There are phone calls. There are dinners. And you can't say, hey, there's a little bit of smoke, we're not going to follow the fire. And the inquiry, my understanding is, as you said earlier, gives us expanded subpoena powers. I want the bank records of Joe Biden. All of that should be on the table to prove out the allegations in the SARS reports. We're talking about a significant sum of money. We are talking about bribery. And in the Constitution, Article 2, Section 4, that is the basis for impeachment.
There's no evidence of bribery.
There are witnesses. I mean, the 1023 form. There are,
And you've been investigating. I mean, you're on the over.
You know, it would take us an hour to go through all of the lies, you know. There are witnesses in the 1023 form, which witnesses they can't find, or who upon being found said, "I actually never spoke to Joe Biden." The bottom line is, the analogy she's using is, there are all of these examples of smoke. And so at some point you've got to wonder, is there smoke because there's fire? Except imagine that it's not really smoke, it's water vapor. And you go, oh, water vapor actually isn't indicative of fire. It's water vapor. That's what's going on here. Now, I promise to you, and I have made this promise before, and I will make it again proudly and strongly, if they find evidence against Joe Biden, either through the fishing expedition, even if it's through the fishing expedition or outside of it, I will tell you, Hunter Biden is now being prosecuted again. Good, go. I mean, if there's evidence, go and prosecute the guy. I'm not looking to stand in the way of justice, but the evidence so far is missing. And there is no reason to believe that what Republicans are doing now is justice. It appears that what they are trying to do now is revenge. Here's another guy, by the way. This is Congressman Michael McCaul. He also went on TV and he also says, we don't have evidence, but maybe we'll find it. I don't know. We might come across some.
That's right. Well, first of all, I've been tasked by the speaker to assist the oversight and government reform with respect to foreign policy decisions the president may have made or vice president at that time with respect to money coming in to try to tie the two. We don't have the evidence now, but we may find it later.
Yeah, we're trying to tie random phone calls to bribe.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Just a few minutes ago, I had the great pleasure of speaking to 7 Americans who are now free. Free from their imprisonment or detention in Iran, out of Iran, out of prison, and now in Doha, en route back to the United States to be reunited with their loved ones.
5 U.S. citizens jailed in Iran have arrived back in the United States after Washington and Tehran agreed to a prisoner swap that involved the unfreezing of $6 billion in Iranian assets. We'll get the latest and talk about the protest movement in Iran a year after the death of Mahsa Amini. Then we look at how the U.S. helped Pakistan get an IMF bailout with a secret arms deal for Ukraine.
Based on secret documents from both the American and Pakistani side, we can report that the U.S. pressured the Pakistanis to begin producing weapons for the Ukraine war effort, and the Pakistanis asked the United States to help them get an IMF loan. That emergency IMF loan was greased in part by the funds from the weapons sales.
We'll speak to The Intercept's Ryan Grimm about Pakistan, as well as the shutdown showdown on Capitol Hill. Will House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's standoff with far-right Republican Congress members lead to a shutdown of the federal government? And here in New York, 149 climate protesters were arrested Monday after they shut down the Federal Reserve in a major act of civil disobedience.
The reason is that the Fed is the one institution that actually has the power to regulate the banks that are financing oil, gas, and coal projects.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has publicly accused the Indian government of assassinating Hardeep Singh Najjar, a prominent independent Sikh leader and a Canadian citizen. In June, Najjar was shot dead outside a Sikh temple in the city of Surrey, British Columbia, by 2 masked gunmen who escaped in a waiting car. His murder sparked widespread fear across Canada's large Sikh community. 3 years before his killing, India's government designated Najjar a terrorist. On Monday, Trudeau blamed India's government for orchestrating his assassination.
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open and democratic societies conduct themselves.
Mr. Trudeau reportedly raised the assassination with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi as well as President Biden. On Monday, Canadian Foreign Minister Melanie Joly said she had expelled India's top intelligence official in Canada. In response, India expelled a senior Canadian diplomat. India has rejected Trudeau's charges, calling them absurd and politically motivated. climate scientists are sounding the alarm over record low levels of sea ice off the coast of Antarctica ahead of the start of spring in the southern hemisphere. Sea ice helps to prevent the rapid flow of ice from Antarctica's glaciers into the ocean, which can drive global sea level rise. Satellite data show 930,000 fewer square miles of sea ice extent surrounding Antarctica compared to the September average, far below any previous winter level. Walter Meyer, a researcher at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, told the BBC, quote, "It's so far outside anything we've seen, it's almost mind-blowing," he said. Here in New York, police arrested at least 149 climate protesters Monday after they flooded Manhattan's financial district for a day of peaceful protests. Activists are demanding banks stop funding coal, oil and gas projects. More protests are planned for today. In Massachusetts, nine members of the environmental movement Extinction Rebellion were arrested Monday as they peacefully occupied the office of Governor Maura Healey to demand an immediate phase out of fossil fuels.
It's going to be hard. We know that. But how much harder is it going to be the longer we wait? We've already waited too long. The people who are in power now are the ones who need to take action now. Stop passing the buck. Stop pushing it down the line. We only have a few years left before it's too late.
We'll have more on this week's historic climate protests later in the broadcast. A Minnesota judge has dismissed criminal charges against three indigenous water protectors who were arrested while protesting at the construction site of Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline in 2021. The three women, Winona LaDuke, Tanya Albid, Dawn Goodwin, were arrested on the banks of the Mississippi River on ceded Anishinaabe land as they sang, danced and prayed near construction crews. In a landmark opinion delivered Monday, Aitkin County Judge Leslie Metzen wrote the women were exercising their rights to free speech and to freely express their spiritual beliefs. The judge dismissed the charges against them in the interests of justice, she said, including, quote, "to criminalize their behavior would be the crime." Five U.S. citizens released from prison in Iran Monday have arrived back in the United States following a rare prisoner swap agreement between the United States and Tehran. They were freed after the U.S. unfroze $6 billion of Iran's oil revenue and released five Iranians held in the United States. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke to the five Americans after their release.
I can tell you that it was for them, for me, an emotional conversation. It's easy in the work that we do every day sometimes to get lost in the abstractions of foreign policy and relations with other countries and forgetting the human element that's at the heart of everything we do.
We'll have more on Iran after headlines. Here in New York, the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly got underway Monday with an urgent call to action on the environment. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said nations need to work urgently to end the triple planetary crisis of climate change, pollution, and biodiversity loss. He also called for a global rescue plan to meet the UN's 17 sustainable development goals, including the elimination of extreme poverty and malnutrition.
In our world of plenty, hunger is a shocking stain on humanity and an epic human rights violation. It is an indictment of every one of us that millions of people are starving in this day and age.
Heads of state from at least 145 countries are attending the UN General Assembly this week. Conspicuously absent are the leaders of four of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council: China, Russia, France, and the UK. President Biden's devoting a substantial portion of his speech today to advocate for increased support for Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is attending the General Assembly for the first time since Russia's invasion in early 2022. He will then head to Washington, D.C., where he will meet with President Biden, but will not again give a joint session of Congress address. The New York Times reports a deadly September 6 strike on a crowded marketplace in eastern Ukraine was the result of an errant Ukrainian air defense missile, not a Russian attack, as was widely first reported. The New York Times cited evidence, including missile fragments, satellite imagery, witness accounts, and social media posts that strongly suggest the catastrophic strike was the result of a Ukrainian radar-guided surface-to-air missile that went astray. At least 15 civilians died, 30 more were injured. Meanwhile, China's foreign minister has begun a four-day trip to Russia. The visit by top diplomat Wang Yi to Moscow comes after he met with White House officials in Malta over the weekend. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with China's vice president on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly ahead of a possible high-level U.S.-China summit later this fall between Biden and Xi. Mexican journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto has been granted asylum in the United States after 15 years of fighting for protection. Gutierrez and his son fled Mexico in 2008 after receiving death threats over Gutierrez's reporting on corruption within the Mexican military in the northern state of Chihuahua. They were detained for 7 months, eventually released to live in the United States while an asylum appeal was pending. Democracy Now! Spoke with Gutierrez by phone in 2017 as he was jailed at a U.S. detention center in El Paso, Texas, awaiting possible deportation.
Well, if we are deported, that obviously implies death. Why? Because ICE, under the Department of Homeland Security of the United States, by law, must give a report to the immigration authorities of Mexico and the consulate. And the immigration officials in Mexico have no credibility. It's impossible to trust in them. To the contrary, many of those officials, many personnel at the consulate or immigration service are caught up with organized crime.
In labor news, striking auto workers have expressed skepticism over President Biden's comments siding with the UAW. United Auto Workers President Sean Fain has said he will not endorse Biden's 2024 reelection run as the union, quote, expects actions, not words. Several Democratic members of Congress have joined the picket line in recent days, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, who made a trip to Detroit Sunday to express solidarity. Meanwhile, Donald Trump said he plans to skip the second Republican presidential primary debate in California next week to speak in Detroit. Trump has accused the current UAW leadership of failing its members and appealed for the support of auto workers. UAW President Fain has also been critical of Trump. This all comes as the strike of some 12,700 auto workers has entered a fifth day. This is UAW member Stu Jackson speaking from a picket line in Wayne, Michigan.
We don't want to wait 4 years to get it. We need it now. We need it now. You know, and that's the way they've been doing us. You know, these bonus checks, we don't need bonus checks. We need cost of living allowance. You know, we need to keep up with what's going on in the economy.
And more than 60 members of Australia's parliament from across the political spectrum have written an open letter urging President Biden to halt his efforts to prosecute Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, who's an Australian citizen, faces espionage and hacking charges that could see him sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified U.S. military and diplomatic cables, including evidence of war crimes. Assange has been held in London's infamous Belmarsh prison since 2019, awaiting possible extradition to the United States. In their open letter, the Australian lawmakers call on the U.S. to abandon its prosecution of Assange, writing, quote, it serves no purpose, it is unjust, and we say clearly, as friends should always be honest with friends, that the prolonged pursuit of Mr. Assange wears away at the substantial foundation of regard and respect that Australians have for the justice system of the United States of America, unquote. The letter appears as an ad in the Washington Post. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Five Americans released by Iran as part of a prisoner swap have arrived back in the United States. They were released Monday, then flown to Qatar, which helped broker the deal in which the United States agreed to drop charges against five Iranians in the United States. In addition, the Biden administration cleared the way for Iran to access $6 billion of its own money that had been frozen in a bank in South Korea. As part of the deal, the money will only be available to Iran to purchase food, medicine, and other non-sanctionable items. Three of the prisoners released by Iran have been identified publicly. Siamak Namazi, who's been detained since 2015, Murad Tabaz, an environmentalist jailed since 2018, and Ahmad Sharghi, who was also arrested in 2018. The names of the other two have not been publicly released. The five prisoners flew on Monday from Tehran to Qatar. They were joined by two other Americans who'd been barred from leaving Iran. Secretary of State Tony Blinken praised the deal.
Just a few minutes ago, I had the great pleasure of speaking to seven Americans who are now free. Free from their imprisonment or detention in Iran, out of Iran, out of prison, and now in Doha, en route back to the United States to be reunited with their loved ones. Five of the seven, of course, had been unjustly detained, imprisoned in Iran, some for years. Two others had been prevented from leaving Iran. I spoke to them after they landed in Doha. I can tell you that it was for them, for me, an emotional conversation. It's easy in the work that we do every day sometimes to get lost in the abstractions of foreign policy and relations with other countries and forgetting the human element that's at the heart of everything we do. But today, their freedom, the freedom of these Americans for so long, unjustly imprisoned and detained in Iran, means some pretty basic things. It means that husbands and wives, fathers and children, grandparents can hug each other again, can see each other again, can be with each other again. So it's a day that I'm grateful for.
Of the five Iranians who had their charges dropped, two have asked to stay in the United States. Another two have returned to Iran, and the fifth is going to an undisclosed country to be with family. Some Republican politicians in the United States have criticized the deal. Texas Congressmember Tom Cotton described the deal as, quote, shameful, and accused the Biden administration of, quote, paying ransom to the world's worst state sponsor of terrorism. That's Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. But family members of the detained Iranian-Americans praised the Biden administration's efforts. In a statement, Ahmad Sharghi's sister, Neda, said, quote, "This is my brother, not an abstract policy. We are talking about human lives. There's nothing partisan about saving the lives of innocent Americans, and today should be a moment of American unity as we welcome them home." The prisoner swap also came as the Biden administration announced new sanctions on Iran's former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and Iran's Ministry of Intelligence for their involvement in what the Biden administration described as, quote, wrongful detentions. The prisoner swap took place 2 days after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, who died in police custody September 16, 2022, just over a year ago, after she was arrested by Iran's so-called morality police, accused of not wearing her hijab properly. Her death sparked months of protests in Iran, a severe crackdown by Iranian authorities. Rights groups estimate 500 people were killed, more than 18,000 arrested over the past year. Ahead of the anniversary, Iranian police detained Mahsa Amini's father, warned him against commemorating his daughter's death. To talk more about the U.S.-Iran prisoner swap and U.S.-Iran relations, we're joined by Nigar Mortazavi. She is an Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy Welcome back to Democracy Now, Nagar. Why don't you start off by talking about the significance of this trade, of the deal that was made, and then we'll talk about the protests.
Good morning, Amy. Let me just make a very quick personal note. This is also very emotional for many of us Iranian Americans. As an Iranian American journalist living in exile who can't travel back to my homeland, specifically because of this issue. This could be me or family members. I actually know one of these prisoners, former prisoners, personally. So this coming back is just a very emotional scene for most Iranian Americans to watch. As far as the policy, I think this is just an example of successful diplomacy between two adversaries, two rivals. It was a long process, very complex process. Iranian and American diplomats didn't even meet in person for these negotiations, for this complex agreement. There was very heavy mediation involved by trusted partners on both sides, mainly the state of Qatar, where diplomats would literally shuttle between hotels where Iranians and American diplomats were staying, and essentially brought this home and were able to choreograph that whole process of the unfreezing of Iranian assets and also the freeing of the five each prisoners on both sides.
And Nagar, what do you make of the timing of this release coming on the eve of the United Nations General Assembly meeting, just as President Raisi of Iran comes to New York? What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how much of this was timed, although it is a pattern that when domestic issues and problems, or I would say repression, and dissent increases, Iran has been trying to do more outreach and more sort of external gains or diplomatic achievements. And this could be one of those. But it's also, let's not remember, this was about a year of intense negotiations, about eight rounds of those indirect negotiations that I talked about. And it was very much reliant on a financial transaction, this big sum of money, $6 billion, that was sitting in South Korea for years, had to be transferred to Europe, be converted, and then go into, be transferred to a bank in Qatar where the Qatari government will have oversight. So I guess both sides wanted this to be done as soon as possible. And that money was, what we got reporting was that it was transferred finally last week. And so these were the steps that came right after it. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Iranians were also trying to time it with the arrival of the president, the Iranian president, into the U.S. in New York for the General Assembly.
And of course, this $6 billion, which some Republicans in the United States are calling a ransom, is actually Iranian money that was frozen by United States sanctions. Could you talk about the sanctions and its impact on the Iranian economy and of the people of Iran?
Sure. Yes, it's essentially ransom paid out of their own pockets. Someone was comparing this to a person going to the bank and taking a hostage and asking to withdraw money out of their own account, essentially. So this was money that was frozen by South Korea oil revenue at the request of the U.S., or essentially in fear of U.S. sanctions or punishment. And the U.S. basically green-lighted to South Korea, or allowed them to unfreeze this money. But the law as far as sanctions hasn't changed. This is an existing humanitarian exemption that has existed under Republican and Democratic administrations when it comes to sanctions law, that certain purchases, very limited purchases, are allowed even for a country that's heavily sanctioned. What are those purchases? Food, medicine, and limited medical supplies. So what's happened is basically a logistical financial transaction where this money was moved from South Korea, converted from Korean won into euros, and now it will be sitting in banks in Qatar with direct oversight by the Qatari government, who will be responsible for paying for the transaction. So the Qataris will not be paying the Iranians. They will be basically paying the suppliers for these humanitarian transactions, and with some oversight also from the U.S., as Qatar is a trusted partner by both sides. So I think this argument is essentially against any humanitarian exemptions to sanctions, which existed as long as sanctions existed, and it gets to the core of of the essentially that exemption, which is allowing food, medicine, and medical supplies, no matter what, under any sanction conditions.
Nigar, can you tell us who the five Iranian Americans are, or why don't we know two of those people where we do not see their pictures, and also who the Iranians are, who two are asking to stay here, two went to Iran, and another to a third country. What were they charged with? They weren't all jailed here, were they?
No, so I'll tell you briefly. On the Iranian side, two have asked, and their families had asked, to remain anonymous. It's just the personal decision of the families. It's sort of that balance. Do you go all out with a media attention to bring more pressure and increase the chance of your loved one being released? Or do you keep quiet and try to resolve this with quiet diplomacy? You know, there's two theories, two ways of doing this. And these two families decided to keep it quiet, and they assumed it would increase the chances of them being released. And I think they still try to remain private and not have the names out. So it was as a personal decision of the detainees and their families. The other three, Siamak Namazi, Emad Sharghi, and Murad Tahbaz, Iranian-American. Murad Tahbaz actually British as well as American, so triple nationality. Siamak Namazi, an Iranian-American businessman, had been held the longest since 2016 in Iran. He's essentially, as he says, has been left behind or forgotten by multiple administrations over the years of his detention. Emad Sharghi, also a businessman from this area, the D.C. area. And Murad Tahbaz is an environmentalist, Iranian-American environmentalist from the Connecticut area. On the U.S. side, the U.S. detention or the Iranian nationals on the U.S. side, it was all related to sanctions violations. So very specific category, not violent crime, not anything domestic, but essentially federally enforced sanctions and exports violations that these Iranian nationals were charged with, that essentially the government dropped the charges. But some of them were already residents of the United States. One was a resident of Canada. So essentially, I think they're going back. Again, it's a personal decision. They're going back to where their lives and families were, or that decision is just a personal decision. And one or two have decided to go back to Iran. So it's been very specific categories. And this was also similar to what happened under the prisoner swap during the Obama administration.
Nigar, I know you have to go, but I wanted to ask you about this anniversary of the killing of Mahsa Amini and her father being arrested, the state of the protest movement in Iran right now, as the president of Iran addresses the UN General Assembly.
Sure. I have a little bit of time. The anniversary was essentially prepared with a very heavy security presence, pressure on families, pressure on activists, universities, anyone who could potentially show any leadership in bringing about a mass movement against a state. The government essentially tried to prevent that with lots of preemptive pressure. But the dissent continues. The grievances are still there. They haven't been addressed, economic, political, and cultural. And I think what we saw over the past year after the death in custody of Mahsa Amini was nothing short of a mass movement and also essentially a cultural revolution. Women and girls said, enough is enough. You can't kill a woman for how she's dressed, which is one reading of the religious attire. And they started defying the mandatory hijab in ways that we haven't seen before. The courage, the bravery, putting their lives and their bodies on the line and saying, I want autonomy, bodily autonomy. I'm going to start dressing the way I want. Young girls, school girls. So the bravery and the courage has been amazing to watch, and it's been constant, ongoing over the past year and still continues. But as far as mass protests, like the way we saw last year, the government and security forces have tried very hard to prevent that.
And have there been any concessions by the government in the past year in terms of the rights of women in Iran?
I don't think we can call them concessions, but women have been able to push the government back essentially by force, by saying, I refuse. I am risking my life. I'm risking arrest. I'm risking my career, my job. Women have been fired. Businesses have been closed. They get fined. They get tickets if they drive without the headscarf. But nevertheless, they continue. And I think the leap or this giant push that they made over the past year would eventually happen maybe in the next decade or two, but it just accelerated it. The killing or death in custody of Mahsa accelerated it, with women essentially channeling this anger into more resistance and more fight. And women in Iran on the ground tell me that there's sort of an unspoken sisterhood, a solidarity, that when they see each other defying the law and not wearing the hijab, they get even more courage, more bravery, and feel like they're not alone. And now there's just so many of them. The Iranian public, the way it looks, has been very, very different. It's dramatically changed since it was last year, and I don't think the government can push it back to where it was before the killing of Mahsa Amini.
Nigar Murtazavi, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, speaking to us from D.C. Next up, we go to Ryan Grimm on how the U.S. helped Pakistan get an IMF bailout with a secret arms deal for Ukraine. And we'll talk about, here in Washington, D.C., the shutdown showdown as House Speaker Kevin McCarthy faces off against his own right-wing Republican lawmakers. Stay with us. برای توی کوچه رخ سیدن برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن برای خواهرم خواهرت خواهرامون برای تغییر مغزها که پوسیدن برای شرمندگی برای بی پولی برای حسرت یک زندگی معمولی برای کودک زبال گرد و آرزوهاش برای این اقتصاد دستوری برای این هوای آلوده برای ولیعصر و درختای فرسوده برای پیروز و احتمال انقراضش برای سگهای بیگناه ممنوعه برای گریه های بیوقفه برای تصویر تکرار این لحظه برای چهره ای که میخنده برای دانش آموزا برای آینده برای این بهشت اجباری برای نخبه های زندانی برای
برای means because of, by the Iranian singer Shirvan Hajipour. It became the unofficial anthem of the Iran protests last year. The song's lyrics were compiled from messages Iranians posted online about why they were protesting. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Biden and other world leaders gather in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, we turn to a major new investigation by The Intercept about how the Biden administration helped Pakistan get a controversial new IMF bailout after Pakistan agreed to secretly sell arms to the United States for the war in Ukraine. According to The Intercept, the secret arms deal was worth about $900 million, money which Pakistan then used to help shore up its financial position in the eyes of the International Monetary Fund. The Intercept reports the deal was discussed at a meeting in Washington in May between Assistant Secretary of State Donald Liu and the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Masood Khan. Pakistan's stance on the war in Ukraine has shifted notably since Russia's invasion and the ouster of Prime Minister Imran Khan, who was removed from office in April 2022. Khan is now imprisoned in Pakistan. In August, The Intercept revealed the existence of a classified Pakistani cable that outlined how the U.S. State Department had encouraged the Pakistani government to remove Khan from office in March 2022, just weeks after Russia had invaded Ukraine. The document stated the U.S. objected to Khan's neutral stance on the war. According to the memo, one State Department official warned Pakistan's ambassador to the United States that, quote, all will be forgiven in Washington if Khan is removed. Since Imran Khan was removed from office, Pakistan has shifted to support the U.S. and Ukraine on the war. At the same time, Pakistan has cracked down on supporters of Imran Khan, and elections have been postponed indefinitely. Meanwhile, the strict conditions of the IMF bailout have sparked mass protest in Pakistan. We're joined now by Ryan Grimm, The Intercept's Washington bureau chief. His latest piece, co-written with Murtaza Hussein, is headlined, U.S. Helped Pakistan Get IMF Bailout with Secret Arms Deal for Ukraine, Leaked Documents Show. So elaborate on this, Ryan Grimm. Talk about the significance of the arms deal and Pakistan's changing position
on the Ukraine war. In fact, it happened to be that Imran Khan was visiting with Russia, President Putin, the day Russia invaded Ukraine.
Right. On top of Khan's neutrality, because, you know, Imran Khan had tried to play a balancing role between the United States, Russia, and China generally. On top of that, he happened coincidentally to be in Russia on the day of the invasion for a long-planned bilateral agreement. And that absolutely, you know, infuriated Washington. You know, several weeks later is when you had that critical meeting where Assistant Secretary Don Liu conveyed Washington's impression, which was that if Khan stays in power, Pakistan will be isolated from the EU and from the United States. But if Khan is pushed out of power, then all will be forgiven, because as Liu put it, Washington understood that Imran Khan's policy was his own policy and not the policy of Pakistan. In other words, that if somebody new were put in place, the hope was that Pakistan would then become a key ally again of the United States in, you know, in its geopolitical struggle generally, but very specifically with Ukraine and Russia. What's key to understand is that the United States doesn't actually have much of an industrial base when it comes to producing the ammunition, munitions, artillery shells, the kind of low-grade weapons that you need for the kind of grinding war that's going on between Ukraine and Russia. If you want a, you know, $100 million F-35 that they're going to lose when it crashes, then the United States is able to produce those, because entire lobbying infrastructures and executive suites and entire, you know, cities outside of Washington, gleaming cities and skyscrapers, can be built up around those. But just producing artillery shells, you know, that's something that the U.S. has kind of outsourced to countries like Pakistan in the past. And so Ukraine was very quickly running low. So what our reporting found is that by August of 2022, so just a few months after Khan was ousted, according to the documents that we reviewed, Pakistan was producing significant amounts of artillery that were being paid for by the United States, shipped to Ukraine and taking part in the war over there. As the economy continued to collapse, Pakistan needed an emergency IMF loan, and the United States agreed to confidentially tell the IMF about the weapons program and about the money that Pakistan was getting from the weapons program to kind of bridge the financing gap that was necessary. Otherwise, there would have been a complete economic meltdown in Pakistan.
And Ryan, in terms of the use of the IMS like this as a political instrument, essentially, what was the impact of the package and the reforms, so-called reforms that the IMF right. always requires of countries in Pakistan, on top of the political convulsion that has been resulted from the removal of the prime minister?
Right. As you know, these reforms always, you know, come at a price to regular people in the country, these kinds of structural adjustments that are insisted on by the IMF. And because of that, the IMF always insists that it negotiate with an elected government that has a mandate from the people. Now, mandate can be broadly defined, because often it's, you know, very directly going in the face of what the will of the people of that particular country is. But at least they want an elected government in place that they can kind of pin these reforms on. They ended up having to raise energy prices by nearly 50% to get this IMF loan. And so the government that followed Imran Khan was able to strike that deal before it turned over to a caretaker government. The goal of the only mandate of a caretaker government is to hold elections. But because this massive IMF deal was in place, Pakistan can now kind of run on cruise control for a while. And so that is the financing that has then allowed them to postpone the elections, and not just postpone the elections, but deepen this very brutal crackdown with, you know, thousands of supporters of Imran Khan getting rounded up, Imran Khan himself in prison, Imran Khan's deputies in prison. This dystopian censorship where Pakistani media outlets are told that they're not even, by the military, that they're not even allowed to mention Imran Khan, which creates these bizarre situations where if he's in a photograph, they'll put kind of like a chyron or some image over him to not run afoul of this bizarre blanket censorship regime that's underway. And so that has all been enabled by this IMF loan, which enabled then the postponing of the elections.
And since Khan was removed from power, what has been Pakistan's position on the war in Ukraine?
Interestingly, the Foreign Office yesterday, in response to our story, flat out denied that they're providing any weapons for the war in Ukraine. Nobody believes that. We're not the first to kind of report on this. We're the first to confirm it with documents. But there's been plenty of video and photographic evidence of munitions, made in Pakistan that are being used, in the Ukraine war. So publicly, they're still proclaiming some sort of neutrality. But you have had comments from the military leadership that have been, hostile towards Russian invasion and have kind of satisfied the United States requirement. And the fact that they're operating this, multi-hundred-million-dollar, it's over a billion by now because our data stopped last summer. The production of the munitions for the war effort makes it clear that after Khan was removed, Pakistan became a reliable ally of the United States in this war.
Before we move on to the showdown on Capitol Hill around the government shutdown, I want to ask you about the person you interviewed, Arif Rafiq, Ryan, who said Pakistani democracy may ultimately be a casualty of Ukraine's counteroffensive. So why would the U.S. and its allies go to such lengths for Pakistan's allegiance to on Ukraine?
Yeah, as you've covered on this show for so long, when the United States has a primary foreign policy objective, in particular when it's a war, everything else falls away. And that's what you're seeing in Pakistan now. And for Pakistanis, the irony is clearly not lost, that the United States and is bringing together kind of the world to stand up for the defense of democracy and sovereignty in Ukraine. Meanwhile, quite deliberately and openly sacrificing democracy in a country of 230 million people in Pakistan, that democracy is being asked, to sacrifice itself for the one in Ukraine. And so it's also caught up in the geopolitics of Pakistan's, shifting relationships with Russia, with China, and with the Gulf countries, which obviously don't even pretend to be, champions of democracy. So now pretty much everyone involved with Pakistan now is no longer, pushing for any defense of civil society or human rights within the borders, though perhaps the protests and the pressure that's coming internally from Pakistan might force some sort of reckoning in the State Department as their rhetoric gets too far removed from the reality.
I wanted to turn now, Ryan Grimm, to Capitol Hill, to the showdown over the potential shutdown of the federal government as House Speaker Kevin McCarthy battles far-right lawmakers, not that he wasn't considered far-right before, but from within his own party. This is McCarthy speaking to reporters Monday.
The one thing I'll tell everybody, I've never seen anybody win a shutdown. You only put the power in the hands of the administration. If you want to secure the border, pass Homeland. If you want to make America strong and secure, you pass the DOD appropriations bill. If you're not willing to pass appropriation bills, and you're not willing to pass a continuing resolution to allow you to pass the rest of appropriation bills, and you don't want an omnibus, I don't quite know what you want.
So that's House Speaker McCarthy sounding not as heated as we heard over the weekend, the F-bombs flying between people like Florida Congressmember Gates, who went to the floor and threatened to remove the House Speaker. Explain everything that's taking place. And do you see this showdown happening? It could happen, within 11 days?
That's right. I do see it happening at this point. And it's hard to really describe kind of how idiotic this whole situation is. And McCarthy did a fairly good job right there. He was saying at the end, I don't know what they want, because there are only a couple different ways to keep the government open. You can either pass a clean CR, which means the way that the government is funded today is the way that the government will be funded into the future until a certain date. You can pass an amended CR, which would say, we're going to continue funding the government, but we want these particular changes. And the House Freedom Caucus has put forward a CR like that, that includes a bunch of draconian kind of immigration and wokeness rules that won't go anywhere in the Senate and won't go anywhere in the White House. But even that has opposition from within the Freedom Caucus. So they can't pass that either. Then you can pass individual appropriations bills, kind of the way that Congress was designed to operate 200 plus years ago when it was built. Every committee passes its funding bill. You pass those bills. Senate passes its bills. President signs them. Done. The government is funded. They can't even agree to do a defense bill. That's supposed to come to the floor today. It might not even pass. They can't agree, as McCarthy said, to do a Homeland Security funding bill. There are 10 other agencies and departments that would need to be funded as well. They can't do that in the next 11 days. They probably couldn't do that over the next year if you gave them that much time. So those are the three options. And the Freedom Caucus is standing in the way of all three of those options. And so notice that I haven't even mentioned Democrats at this point. So this is fully, completely in the hands of the caucus, which is unable to even get its own members to agree on something, which is then going to walk them off the cliff of a government shutdown in a way that doesn't even give them a fig leaf of to cover the fact that they didn't do anything. At least with the debt ceiling crisis, if you remember, they passed some completely untenable legislation through the House. So at least they said, look, we did our part. We lifted the debt ceiling, but it came with all these things that obviously Biden's never going to sign. But at least they put it through the House of Representatives. It looks like this time they might not even be able to do that. And if McCarthy then relies on Democrats to try to keep the government open, they're saying, well, then we're going to throw McCarthy out of the speakership. Then they have the problem of who are they going to replace him with? They have no idea because they don't have a majority. They don't have 218 votes for a new speaker. So they don't like the way things are going. They have no idea what to do instead. And so we're just going to get a shutdown until there's enough pressure on them that they just capitulate again. And it's ironic.
Ryan, what is these continuing battles of the last several years over government shutdowns? What does this say about the increasing contradictions and the ruling circles in the U.S. society that they can't agree among themselves as to spending bills?
I feel like, and I'm still kind of thinking through this myself, I'm curious for your guys' take. Back when Washington was really the subject of interest group competition, labor, environmentalists, major corporations, grassroots organizations like, say, the NRA, you fought over legislation and you fought over outcomes because people were jockeying for actual power. But I think what's developed now is that you have a lot of the kind of quote unquote interest groups who are interested in Washington are like, for instance, YouTubers like Steve Bannon, who has a gigantic podcast called The War Room, which has millions of people who are kind of worked up about what's going on in the House of Representatives. And what they want to see is a fight. They want to see a show. And Matt Gaetz has said as much, that they don't necessarily expect Matt Gaetz to win every fight, but they expect him to fight. And so they want the theater of it. They want to see that they sent somebody to Washington who is fighting for them. What they're fighting for, whether they win, whether their situation actually gets worse as a result, is secondary to the kind of emotional release that people want from seeing a clash unfold in Washington. You've seen some of this on the left as well, they just want to see a fight. They just want to know that they're kind of represented in Washington, even if it's hopeless, even if they don't have, they won't even put forward an idea of how they're going to win this showdown. So I feel like that's sort of what's reflected in what we're seeing here, because otherwise you can't make any sense of it from a strategic or tactical sense if you are thinking about outcomes or substance or results that you want from this.
Ryan, we only have a minute. We last had you on discussing prosecutors indicting President Biden's son Hunter on felony charges of illegally possessing a handgun and making false statements in order to get the gun in 2018. Well, on Monday, Hunter Biden filed a federal lawsuit against the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, for allegedly violating his privacy, saying two of its investigators divulged confidential tax information when they testified before Congress. And last week, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy opened an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. Can you talk about these developments?
It's an interesting case that Hunter has filed. Now, the whistleblowers, you know, when they initially came forward to Congress, they said that, you know, as good IRS agents, you know, what we're revealing does not violate any particular, you know, privacy rights of any particular taxpayers, because, you know, the IRS does, you know, not only have a legal mandate around that, but they have a cultural one, too, that the people within the IRS are very cautious about revealing private information. But certainly this tax fight has spilled out into the press. So it would certainly be ironic if the IRS ended up having to pay Hunter Biden for, and it depends on, you know, what jury he gets. Maybe this is also some leverage that his lawyers are trying to get against the attorneys, because there's still the unfolding FARA case, which is was Hunter Biden illegally acting as a foreign agent without disclosing or without registering? That fight is the reason that the entire plea deal broke down in the first place.
Well, very interesting to see his very powerful lawyer, Abby Lowell, who also represented Steve Bannon.
And the Kushners.
The Kushners. Ryan Grimm, we want to thank you so much for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. We'll link to your piece that you wrote with Murtaza Hussein, headlined U.S. Help Pakistan Get IMF Bailout with Secret Arms Deal for Ukraine, Leaked Documents Reveal. Ryan's Substack newsletter is Bad News. Next up, we speak with one of the 149 climate protesters arrested Monday after they shut down the Federal Reserve here in New York, calling for an end to fossil fuel investments. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the U.N. General Assembly brings world leaders to New York this week, some will attend the first-ever Climate Ambition Summit Wednesday, focused on efforts to accelerate and address the climate crisis. President Biden speaks today at the General Assembly, but will not attend the climate summit. This comes after an estimated 75,000 people marched to the United Nations Sunday to demand Biden end fossil fuels. On Monday, activists escalated calls for climate action with one of the largest acts of civil disobedience in a decade. They gathered in Zuccotti Park, the former site of Occupy Wall Street, then surrounded the Federal Reserve Bank, blockading the entrances as they called for an end to the financing of fossil fuel projects. Organizers say 149 were arrested, including climate defiance organizer Riley Hout.
I'm being arrested for exercising my First Amendment right to protest because Joe Manchin is putting a 300-mile-long pipeline through my home state of West Virginia, and President Biden allowed him to do it for nothing in return. He has sold us out. He's promised to end drilling on federal lands. It's a promise he made to all of us, and he's selling out Appalachian futures for profit. He's selling us out, and we're going to drown in dirty water and dirty air.
This comes as climate protests targeted Citibank and AIG last week for funding fossil fuel projects, and today focus on Bank of America, which the Rainforest Action Network says has poured $279 billion into the fossil fuel industry since the 2015 Paris Agreement to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. For more, we're joined by Renata Pumarol, organizer with Climate Defenders, one of the groups that's been planning this week's climate change direct action in New York, and Elise Nascimento, the campaign director at New York Communities for Change. She was arrested during the protest Monday at the Federal Reserve. We welcome you both. Elise, let's start with you. Talk about why you got arrested yesterday. Talk about the Federal Reserve here in New York.
Thank you, Amy. First, thank you so much for having me. I, unlike many of my colleagues who blocked the doors yesterday to the Federal Reserve and put their bodies on the line, I was actually not planning to be arrested. I simply grabbed a bullhorn and I contextualized where we were as a number of our colleagues were getting arrested. And I called out the Fed for its responsibility to regulate climate risk as financial risk, and also the responsibility of our elected officials, especially Democrats and financial regulators, and their utter failure in this time of crisis. And the police told me that I could not use a bullhorn, in spite of the fact that we were all using bullhorns, and that if I continued on speaking out, that they would arrest me. And I continued on speaking out because it's important. And then they proceeded to arrest me. So it came as a surprise. But at the same time, it's what, you know, we're really trying to bring the urgency of the crisis to the folks who are responsible for it. And the Fed is really failing in its role, not just its role, but really its duty and responsibility to make sure that banks are no longer financing new fossil fuel infrastructure.
I'd like to bring Renata Appel-Marol into the conversation. Renata, you were participated in the protests. The recent protests have targeted financial institutions like Citibank and BlackRock. Why them?
Well, BlackRock and Citibank are one of the biggest funders of fossil fuels. Citibank is actually the second largest fossil fuel financier in the world and has poured over $333 billion into fossil fuels, and therefore are complicit in the climate chaos that we are experiencing. Your audience know that, you know, climate chaos is not in some distant future. We are facing unprecedented heat waves and floods and fires that have killed tens of thousands of people, and it will only get worse if we do not stop the fossil fuel industry. And the only way to stop the fossil fuel industry is to stop the financing of fossil fuels. And that's why this week, hundreds of activists targeted the financiers of fossil fuels, like BlackRock, like KKR, and Citibank, and today Bank of America. These are the people who are funding the pipelines that are destroying indigenous communities and threatening our water. They are the ones who are funding petrochemical facilities in black and brown communities and causing high rates of cancer and of asthma. And they are ultimately responsible for climate change and climate chaos that is threatening our existence and are threatening, a livable future.
And could you talk about how your own relatives in Northeast Brazil are being impacted by the climate catastrophe?
So actually, this is, I think this question is meant for Alice, who is from Brazil.
I'm from the Dominican Republic.
No worries. I'm from Dominican Republic, though. And, you know, as you know, from the Caribbean islands are highly threatened by climate change. We have experienced, like, you know, stronger hurricanes, you know, in the case of Puerto Rico, which was devastated by Hurricane Maria. And we are also facing unprecedented heat waves, too. And I'll take it back to Alice to talk about Brazil and how her country has been affected.
Alice, yeah. If you could respond in Brazil.
Absolutely. I mean, as many of you know, of course, Brazil is really at the forefront in the battle to save our planet with having the Amazon rainforest there and indigenous communities really not only fighting for their lives, but fighting for the future of our planet in protecting the Amazon, since they're all, you know, technically considered protected lands under Brazil's constitution. So that's really the only thing that's maintaining that underdeveloped and not and decreasing the levels of deforestation now that Lula has become president. But for me personally, I'm from the northeast of Brazil, Salvador, Bahia. It's very right by the equator. It's a city that's right by the beach. And increasingly, you know, in the winters, there's rainy season. And it always rains, but now it's just become, there's so many floods. There's my father's house recently, his roof completely collapsed. And this is really the impacts of climate change. It's something that we're used to seeing rain in Brazil, but not to this degree. And of course, it impacts everyone, but particularly the folks who are on the front lines, who are poor and don't necessarily have the means to rebuild their house or to have shelter.
Finally, Renata, this comes after 75,000 people marched. The focus was President Biden. Biden and fossil fuels, the banner across the stage. Why President Biden? We have 20 seconds.
Well, Biden, you know, of course, is the president of the United States, the most powerful powerful country, is also the biggest producer of oil and gas. And Biden can stop new fossil fuel projects right now and has chosen not to do so and has chosen actually even not to attend the climate summit and commit himself to stop.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to continue to cover the climate actions across the week. Renata Pumarol and Elise Nascimento. I'm Amy Goodman. With Juan Gonzalez, thanks for joining us.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh. Right now, we're going on a little trip. My name is DJ Tony Tunes, and I hope you're prepared to go on a little journey back to the 80s you never knew. Right now, we're going to go on one little trip for just an hour